Thank you, Dean Bush, for the introduction, and I would like to thank you as our academic dean and President Aiken and our entire faculty for the opportunity to deliver this lecture today. While I realize on the one hand I'm invited to do this merely because it's my turn, my name is the next one on the list, on the other hand, I woke up this morning thinking that what a blessing it is for my name to be on that list. It is a great blessing for me to have the opportunity to serve with godly men and women who love Jesus and love God's Word and serve Him through this faculty and our great scholars. And so I never want to take that for granted. And so I'm grateful to God for that. The topic for today's lecture, Sheol, began to form in my mind as a possible topic for this lecture about 2 years ago. I was unsure about the topic for the lecture, and so I decided to ask a few of my colleagues what they thought about it. One colleague thought that it would be over the heads of our students. I thought that he was incorrect. That colleague is now at Southwestern Seminary, where he probably is correct. Other colleagues made wisecracks like, you know, it's a dead issue, or, you know, you'll have to bury yourself in study or so forth. And one colleague truly said absolutely nothing, evidently following the old adage, if you can't say something good, don't say anything at all. Well, these responses from my colleagues, I had to admit, fell a little short of the enthusiasm for which I had been looking, but I decided to go ahead with my study of Sheol anyway, because the truth is, I wanted to research the topic of Sheol and talk with you about it for two reasons. First of all, I'm interested in the Old Testament's theology of the afterlife and Sheol's place in that, and I've not been satisfied with many of the things I've read about it, and secondly, I wanted to talk about this with you because whether you know this or not, it will be helpful to you. Sometime in the future, maybe after a Wednesday night Bible study, a fellow believer will ask you a question. The question will indicate that this person, instead of listening to the Bible teacher, as good Christians are supposed to do, he started mischievously reading the Bible in other passages where it's dangerous to read. And in doing so, his eyes fell on the word Sheol. Having no idea what this word meant, immediately the thought formed in his mind, I shall ask a seminary student what it means since they know everything. And so the question comes to you, what is Sheol? And in that moment, you will not have the opportunity to answer as your professors answer when they're asked a question they don't know anything about. They merely say, we'll cover that later in the semester. And that gives them time to study and formulate some response to that question. No, you'll have to answer this church member. And this lecture is for the purpose of helping you to do so in a way that's faithful to what the Bible says and to what it means. First of all, I want to say a few words about my methodological presuppositions. These presuppositions may seem to those in this room so basic that they hardly need to be mentioned, but I hope to demonstrate that these methodological presuppositions are necessary in light of the methodological presuppositions of noteworthy Old Testament scholars that differ significantly from the presuppositions of this paper. First of all, my approach is canonical. My presupposition is that the Old Testament is one canon of Scripture. It's true that for Christians, the Old Testament is only the first part of our canon. But what I mean here is that the Old Testament is a unified whole. And that whole is inspired by God and therefore authoritative. So we may speak of the Old Testament conception of Sheol, or life after death. While there may have been some development in this conception, this is something different than the theological segregation common among Old Testament scholars who've written of the differences between pre-exilic and post-exilic conceptions of death, or the differences between the theology of the Torah versus the theology of the prophets, etc. Instead, this paper reflects the perspective that the Old Testament is one revelation from God. That revelation developed or progressed since it was given over time, but the entire corpus speaks with a unified voice. The later revelations do not contradict the former. Instead, they complement and complete them. A second note about methodology is that my approach is revelational. Some scholars have written that other religions and other cultures had a substantive influence on the development of the Hebrew conception of the afterlife as it's reflected in the Hebrew scriptures. Harris Berkland, for example, wrote that the belief in the resurrection of the dead that is detectable in the documents of the Old Testament, it was the result of theological evolution within Judaism plus the influence of Zoroastrianism in Iran. And his approach is common among Old Testament scholars. Joachim Jeremias is an example of a New Testament scholar with the same approach. He wrote that such ideas as the division of the underworld into two compartments and a differentiation of destinies between the righteous and the wicked were the results of contact with the Greeks and the Persians. Such a position sounds historically plausible, but it becomes less plausible when one actually reads the Greek and Persian documents and sees the rather fantastic portrayals of the spiritual world that differ fundamentally from the Old Testament. In light of these basic and numerous differences, any similarities may be seen as incidental, and they should be set in the context of the enormous contrast. A better explanation for the development of the Old Testament conception of the afterlife would be to see it as a spirit-guided flowering of nascent ideas in earlier Old Testament texts. And as for the Persians, Greeks, and others getting some things right, the Bible prepares us for that with the repeated claim of general revelation. A third methodological note is that my orientation is monotheistic. Walter Brueggemann, in an article on the theology of death in the Old Testament, referred to death as an active personal agent in combat with Yahweh. Such a dualistic conception, even in an incipient form, is foreign to the Old Testament. Instead, the Old Testament is consistently, even fiercely, monotheistic. The documents concerning death from other ancient Near Eastern cultures portrayed the realm of the dead in mythological terms. And in some literature, the place of the dead had its own pantheon. Well, in contrast with that, the Old Testament explicitly and frequently asserts that there is only one God, Yahweh, and that His sovereignty extends to the realm of death. Far from being a competing personal agent, as in Canaanite theology, for example, death is actually an impersonal place of existence that is subject to the rule of the one and only true God. Having stated these methodological presuppositions, let's turn to the meaning of the word Sheol. You'll see several meanings on the slide there. I have time only to talk about one. One term that's often mentioned as the root for the term Sheol is the verb meaning to ask. If indeed this verb should be regarded as the root for Sheol, maybe the idea was that Sheol was the great asker. It invites the living into the afterlife and awaits a response. Robert Frost once wrote that a star asks a little of us here. Well, the afterlife, Sheol, asks a lot of us here, our lives. On the other hand, Clement McNasby wrote that the verb to ask may have been the root for Sheol because of the practice of necromancy, which was divination by means of asking questions of the dead. So the close association between divination and departed spirits, the place of the dead, came to be regarded as the great asking place. Alexander has proposed yet another reason why the verb meaning to ask may be the root for the term referring to the place of the dead. He suggested that perhaps Sheol originally denoted what he called an examination ordeal and eventually came to refer to the netherworld. College and seminary students, it seems to me, might especially be sympathetic with this etymological connection. They can understand how going through an examination is indeed an ordeal. So a historical development from a term meaning test to a term meaning hell is quite easy for you to imagine, probably. So, what can we conclude from these various etymological theories? The answer is not very much. The only consensus among Old Testament scholars concerning the etymology of Sheol is that no consensus exists. So we're left to consider the meaning of the word Sheol by considering each Old Testament context in which the word occurs, which is more important anyway. Nothing can substitute for a careful translation of every verse in which the word Sheol occurs, and a consideration of the near and far contexts of each verse. This is the necessary consideration of all the biblical data, not part of it. And this kind of study is especially important for the subject of Sheol, since it has been rather common for Old Testament scholars to make rather sweeping comments about the Old Testament conception of Sheol and the afterlife, statements that do not take into consideration all of the biblical data regarding the subject. For example, Bruce Vauder, he described the Old Testament conception of death and Sheol as an eternal sleep. Colleen McDaniel and Bernard Lang wrote of Sheol, upon death, fellowship with Yahweh ceased. And they said, Yahweh remembered the dead no more. These are misleading generalizations based on a fraction of the biblical data, and they amount to misstatements. A description of Sheol is needed that takes into consideration the whole of the biblical revelation. In order to attempt such a description, I offer four initial observations about the use of the word Sheol in the Old Testament. These are facts about the use of the term that stood out to me as I translated all of these passages and noted their similarities and dissimilarities. First of all, the Hebrew word Sheol does not occur with the definite article. It's never the Sheol, it's always Sheol. This anarthrous form indicates that it is used in the Old Testament as a proper noun or a title, not a common noun. That fact alone is probably sufficient to warrant rendering the Hebrew term Sheol as a transliteration instead of trying to translate the term. The more recent literal English translations do just that. They transliterated as Sheol, capital S, so indicating that the word should be taken as a proper noun, an actual place with an actual name. On the other hand, the King James Version does not transliterate Sheol, it translates it. The King James translators rendered Sheol as grave 31 times and hell 31 times and the pit 3 times. Rendering it as hell may have been influenced by the Septuagint, which translates it as Hades, and the Vulgate, which uses the Latin word infernus. The New International Version, true to its paraphrasing tendencies, translates the proper noun Sheol, translates it instead of transliterating it as a proper noun. So 57 times the New International Version translators use the word the grave to translate Sheol. So the NIV translators clearly preferred to translate Sheol as the grave, but inexplicably 6 times they switched and translated as death. 6 times, and once they used the realm of the dead and once the depths. Second observation is that Sheol occurs 10 times with the Hebrew suffix known as the directional he, or it's sometimes called the old accusative ending. This indicates motion towards Sheol, not residence in Sheol. Surely the former is to be preferred to the latter, and probably this has theological significance, which we don't have time to explore this morning. Third, perhaps the most obvious fact to the one who translates these verses with the word Sheol is its provenance in passages that are poetic. Of the 65 occurrences of the term, 16 are in Psalms, 9 are in Proverbs, 8 in Job, and 1 in Song of Songs. These are 34 uses that are clearly in poetic passages that are marked by parallelism. Additionally, the 19 occurrences in the prophetic books are in prophetic poetry. with the parallelism and symbolic language that are typical of Hebrew poetry. In addition, three more times, Sheol is used in poetry that is located in a passage that is primarily narrative in form. For example, Moses' song at the end of his life, Hannah's prayer of praise after the birth of Samuel, and also David's song after the Lord had delivered him from the Philistines and Saul and other enemies. We could add also four occurrences of Sheol found in the Jacob-Joseph stories. This was when Jacob was waxing eloquent about how awful were his circumstances and how sure was his sorrowful demise, and his melodramatic lament is very close to poetry. This leaves only five occurrences of Sheol in non-poetic passages. Two of these are in the story of the ground opening up to swallow those who rebelled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Two additional prose occurrences are on the mouth of David when he invites Solomon to execute Joab and Shimei, not to allow them to go down to Sheol in peace. That was a circumlocution for killing them. Don't let their gray head go down to Sheol in peace. That leaves only one more occurrence of Sheol in a prose passage, and that's in the wisdom book of Ecclesiastes. The obvious fact is that Sheol is used almost exclusively as a poetic term in the Old Testament. In my view, this has implications for interpreting the meaning of the term in the Old Testament. However, the poetic provenance of the term Sheol often has not been taken into consideration. For example, Wachner wrote that the Israelite conception of the dead included the idea that Sheol was, he wrote, closed off with locks and gates. Well, that's a literalistic interpretation of the phrase, the gates of Sheol, in the Old Testament, and it's inappropriate in light of the fact that this phrase occurs in poetic passages. Similarly, Larry Hillier has written a list of nine characteristics of Sheol that are described in the Old Testament. Some of those characteristics are questionable once the poetic nature of the cited passages are taken into consideration. For example, he described Sheol as a place of complete silence based on Psalm 115, the idea that the dead go down to silence. Are we to think of a place that is speechless or even soundless for all of eternity? Or is it possible that the writer was writing metaphorically of silence? I think the latter is more likely, and I think that the theological implications of the poetic nature of many of the passages that contain the word Sheol have not been explored adequately by Old Testament scholarship, and this deserves greater attention. And we will be sure to cover that later in the semester. At this point, however, let's move to a fourth general observation about the use of Sheol in the Old Testament. In about half of the uses of the term, parallel terms occur. That's the defining characteristic of Hebrew poetry, parallelism. And these terms that commonly refer in parallelism with one another, that are often paired together, are called word pairs. For example, words death, the pit, Abaddon, all occur in parallelism with the word Sheol. Now, having considered briefly the etymology of the term and some general observations about its use in the Old Testament, I want to ask the important question of meaning. This is the central question. What does the word Sheol refer to in the Old Testament? I want to approach this by reviewing basically five different positions to answer that question. First of all, R. Laird Harris has popularized the view that Sheol does not describe, I'm quoting him, does not describe the place where the souls of men go, but the place where their bodies go, the grave. And to support that position, Harris pointed out that Sheol is used as a poetic synonym for the terms grave and pit. Remember, they occur in parallelism with one another. Also, some of the Old Testament descriptions of Sheol seem to be merely descriptions of an underground tomb, including references to dust and worms and decay. He also pointed out that the Old Testament concept of Sheol has been used to support unbiblical ideas, such as an intermediary state of purgatory and an undifferentiated destiny for the righteous and the wicked. And Harris believes that interpreting Sheol merely as a reference to what happens to the body takes away support from those aberrant positions. Well, in response to Harris's position, it should be said that in some passages, it's easy to see how Sheol can be taken to refer to the grave, but it's difficult to see how the meaning of a physical grave or a tomb exhausts the meaning of all the Old Testament passages that contain the term Sheol. Four Psalms, for example, explicitly connect the soul with Sheol, not just the body. And in the book of Job, Zophar speaks of the impossibility of knowing the depths of Sheol. Well, according to Laird's interpretation, in order to know the depths of Sheol, one would just have to dig a few feet down into a grave. Hardly an impossible task. And furthermore, in three passages, Sheol stands in contrast with the heavens or heaven, where heaven clearly refers to a far-off extremity, or not merely the space above the ground where the birds fly. Sheol and the heavens are, in the words of one scholar, juxtaposed in order to indicate the lowest and highest regions of the cosmos. So in my view, Laird's interpretation of Sheol as a reference only to the physical grave does not do justice to all the occurrences of the term. Second, some scholars have stated that the authors of the Old Testament wrote of Sheol as the final resting place of all persons, whether wicked or righteous. This view is often accompanied or occasioned by the belief that Old Testament ideas about death and the place of the dead reflect a primitive stage of development in human thought. This view is also customarily accompanied by frequent allusions to similarities between the Old Testament and other ancient Near Eastern documents that address the topic of death and the place of death. The Old Testament conception of Sheol is said to have been borrowed from notions of the underworld recorded by other ancient Near Eastern cultures. And this notion is something like this. At death, both the pious and the wicked enter the dreary abode of the dead, a place of shades and semi-existence that lacks animation or the dynamism of human life, to borrow phrases from several sources. The underworld is neither a place of reward nor a place of punishment. It is a sleepy place without moral distinctions. Well, by way of evaluating this position, it is possible that some Hebrews conceived of a place that was neither heaven nor hell, and in which all the dead gathered either forever or until some sort of resurrection. But this position was not held by the orthodox Yahwism that is expressed in the Old Testament. This is not the view of the biblical writers. If all the dead go to the same place, how are we to explain the Old Testament warnings to the wicked that they are in danger of entering Sheol? And how are we to explain the expressions on the part of the righteous of their joyful anticipation of death? No, the idea that the righteous and the wicked enter a shadowy place where they dwell forever in some sort of semi-existence, it may be compatible with some documents from other ancient Near Eastern cultures, but it is not compatible with clear assertions of the Old Testament. Now I want to turn to a third interpretation of the term Sheol in the Old Testament. The view that I just described was never widely accepted in the church or in the synagogue. However, the Catholic Church modified this view to a more acceptable form. The modifications allow for some differentiation in the destinies of the wicked and the righteous while still maintaining the idea of one place of the dead. Specifically, two fringe compartments were added to Sheol. The Latin phrase limbus patrum was used to denote the first compartment. The phrase means fringe of the fathers. The idea was that this was the place where the Old Testament saints were located until Christ's resurrection from the dead. According to medieval Catholic teaching, after his crucifixion, Jesus descended into this abode of the fathers, releasing them from their temporary accommodations and taking them to heaven. This was the limbus patrum. A second fringe compartment that was added to Sheol was called the limbus infantum, or fringe of the infants. When I read about this, what came to my mind was that maybe it was sort of the preschool department of hell. Every preschool minister has his or her own conception of hell. Not enough beds or floor space, too many babies, not enough workers. Creepy middle-aged men insisting that they can keep the preschoolers all by themselves. That's their idea of hell. I'm being facetious, of course, but the limbus infantum was actually the abode of all unbaptized children. Roman Catholic doctrine does not allow for unbaptized children to be in heaven, but the idea of these little ones burning in hell was also objectionable to Roman Catholic theologians, who incidentally were the creepy middle-aged men of the middle-aged Roman Catholic Church. So the idea was born that place the children in the outskirts of hell, sort of in the suburbs, where the terrible fires of hell do not reach. And whereas the suburbs of hell may be preferable to its inner city, unfortunately the unbaptized children still remain in the limbus infantum forever, with no hope of deliverance to heaven. And what should we say by way of evaluating this view? It seems daunting to assess it biblically, since there's nothing in the Bible about these two compartments. And for evangelicals, that should be enough evaluation to conclude that this is not a viable interpretation of Sheol. As William Shedd put it, Sheol is one, undivided, homogeneous in the inspired representation. The subdivision of it into heterogeneous compartments is a conception imported into the Bible. Fourth interpretation has been offered by Desmond Alexander. According to Alexander, all persons enter Sheol, regardless of their righteousness or their relatedness to Yahweh. Then at some point subsequent to their death, the righteous will be resurrected to live forever with the Lord. In response to that position, the Old Testament does not contain evidence of the presence of the righteous in Sheol. So it's difficult to accept Alexander's interpretation as the correct one. The descriptions of the afterlife that contain some detail about the place of the dead describe either the wicked or the righteous, not the two together in the same place. On this point, let's just consider one description of Sheol in Ezekiel 31 and 32. The word Sheol occurs five times. The words pit and grave also occur frequently, and the word underworld appears once as well. All these terms are used interchangeably in these two chapters to refer to the place of death. The context of these verses is the Lord's command to Ezekiel to announce the Lord's coming judgment on Egypt. And the judgment will end in the presence of Egypt's army in Sheol. And what follows is an extended description of Sheol, in which the Lord allowed Ezekiel to take a tour of Sheol so that the prophet could accurately portray Egypt's destination after her destruction. In these verses, Ezekiel describes what he sees in Sheol, as if walking from place to place. He writes, like a tourist who took a wrong turn and wound up in hell. Now, some of us have had vacations like that. Nevertheless, while the Lord was giving Ezekiel a tour of the place, he decided to make the best of it and buy some postcards to send them home. And so he sent them back to the enemies of the Lord in Egypt with messages like, having a good time, wish you were here. Indeed, Egypt would be in Sheol in the near future, because the point of the passage is to announce the Lord's intention to send Egypt there. But before Egypt was to arrive in Sheol, Ezekiel saw that many people were already there. And the point I'd like to stress here is that those in Sheol are exclusively the ungodly. Every group of people is described with the word uncircumcised, which in the Old Testament was the ultimate insult and a clear indication that the inhabitants of Sheol were outside the people of God. This depiction of Sheol as free from any godly person is consistent in the Old Testament. And that contrasts with the idea that the circumcised are in Sheol awaiting their future resurrection. To the contrary, the righteous simply are not there. This prepares us for a fifth and final interpretation of Sheol, which is one that I would commend. This interpretation takes into consideration all the uses of the word Sheol in the Old Testament, and it proposes that the word has not actually one meaning, but several meanings, but just two meanings in the Old Testament. We know that it's not unprecedented for a term to have several meanings. Linguists refer to this as a word semantic domain. They have a range of meanings, not just one meaning. So, two meanings. First of all, Sheol is used as a reference to death. Used in this way, Sheol does not refer to the physical grave, nor to an abode for spirits, whether righteous or wicked. Instead, this is a general reference to the end of physical life. This is the most common way the word Sheol is used in the Old Testament. It appears with this meaning 45 times out of the total 65 occurrences of the word. Let me just mention two lines of evidence here to support this idea. First of all, the word Sheol and the word death are actually parallel terms no less than 17 times in the Old Testament. Consider just a couple of examples. First of all, late in the life of King David, after the Lord had delivered him from Saul and other enemies, he sang a song of praise to the Lord. 2 Samuel 22:6. He said, "The cords of Sheol surrounded me, the snares of death confronted me." Seems clear enough here that David is referring to the fact that his life had been in danger. Death seemed imminent. In this sentence that conforms to the standard conventions of Hebrew poetry, David referred to death explicitly, and in the parallel line, he used the synonym for death, in this case, Sheol. Also worthy of mention, I think, is Psalm 6, verse 6, another passage where death and Sheol are synonymously parallel. The verse addressed the Lord with these words, "There is no remembrance of you in Sheol," in death. "In Sheol, who gives thanks to you?" This verse is often used as evidence that the Old Testament teaches that the realm of Yahweh does not extend to the place of the dead, or that the dead have no awareness of God, or that the place of the dead is some sort of semi-existence. These ideas arise from a misinterpretation of Psalm 6:6. In the Hebrew Bible, the word remembrance has cultic significance. To remember a deity was not merely to regain awareness of a deity after having forgotten who he was. Instead, remembering a deity was to invoke that deity's name in worship. If you want to see an example of that, turn to Hosea 2:17. Well, in the sixth psalm here, the psalmist had temple worship in view. He was saying that there is no temple worship in death. And he used the word Sheol as synonymously parallel to death. So the psalmist opined, this would be one of death's bitter pills. He could no longer gather with God's people in worship and give thanks to the Lord. So the first indication that Sheol is used to refer to death is its synonymous parallelism with the word death. We've looked at only two examples. There are 15 more in the Old Testament. Second, Sheol occurs in numerous passages in which the context indicates that what is intended by the word Sheol is merely a reference to death. One example is Hezekiah's reference to his own brush with death. He described his experience by saying, "I said, in the peacefulness of my days I will leave. To the gates of Sheol I have been assigned." Hezekiah was not merely referring to his body being laid in a tomb. He was certainly not consigning himself to hell. He was simply stating that he had been about to die. Another example of Sheol referring to death is David's advice to his son Solomon. Just before he died, David counseled Solomon to execute Joab and Shimei. Of Joab, he said to Solomon, "You shall not allow his gray head to go down to Sheol in peace." And he said similar words about Shimei. Well, one could conclude that David might have been referring to an eternal abode for the wicked because of the apparently unrighteous lives of Joab and Shimei. But there's nothing in the immediate context to suggest that David had anything in view except to offer to Solomon advice in running his administration in this life, not the next. So David's counsel was to get rid of them by killing them. And to say that, he used the colloquial expression, send them to Sheol. In some contexts, Sheol is used figuratively or rhetorically, but still the references are to death. The rhetorical techniques include personification and localization. Personification is used when Sheol is said to have a mouth, or when Sheol swallows, or when Sheol is taking people, and so forth. Personification and localization. We won't have time to talk about either one of those, except to ask this question. Why would Old Testament texts localize the concept of death using the word Sheol? The reason such localizing was appropriate is because elsewhere, Sheol was used to refer to an actual locality, the place of punishment for the wicked. That leads us to the second way in which the term Sheol is used in the Old Testament. First of all, it referred generally to death. Second, it is used to refer to hell. It is the Old Testament term that refers to the permanent abode of the ungodly. So the translators of the Septuagint and the King James Version were on the right track, using Hades and hell to translate Sheol. On the other hand, the Septuagint uses Hades in places where Sheol just refers to death in general. Same thing with the King James Version using hell. And so it is still best to transliterate the term as Sheol and not to try to translate it, in my view. Let's look at a few contexts to note this. I'll just note one. The first, that's Isaiah 14. In this chapter, Isaiah prophesied that the day would come when Babylon would fall. When that happened, Israel would mock Babylon with an extended taunt. And Isaiah provided the poetic words of that taunt, which included the word Sheol three times. Some evangelical commentators take Isaiah 14 to be a reference to Satan, but I see it referring exclusively to the king of Babylon. Either way, Sheol refers to hell, the place where the dead are punished. And the book of Psalms contains also two references to the permanent abode of the wicked as well, and we will skip those. So the Old Testament term refers either to the state of death or to the permanent dwelling place of the wicked. We've already hinted in our consideration of these Old Testament texts, we've already hinted that the righteous have in store a different eternal destiny, but the Old Testament does more than hint at that truth. The Old Testament introduces a different outcome for the righteous with the description of Enoch as early as the genealogy of Genesis 5. Enoch differs in two ways from the others in that genealogy. First, he walked with God. Second, he did not die. Instead, God took him. The meaning of the word took here indicates that God took Enoch to himself. It would make no sense to interpret this to mean that God took Enoch to Sheol. The whole point of the contrast is to show that God did something different with Enoch that was a reward for walking with him. And the Old Testament contains further support for a different destiny for the righteous. 1 Samuel 2:6, Hannah prayed, "The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and raises up." That's a clear statement of differentiated destinies. And the Lord is the source of those destinies. In other words, some people go to Sheol and some people are raised up. And both of those destinies are the work of the Lord. Hannah expressed this truth in a prayer as an attribute of Yahweh for which he is to be praised. That's 1 Samuel 2. But in Psalm 30, verse 4, the psalmist expressed the same truth in a personal testimony. "Lord, you have raised my soul from Sheol. You have made me alive from going down to the pit." So the psalmist said that the Lord had raised him from going to Sheol. Listen to the similar statement in Psalm 86, 13. "You deliver my soul from the depths of Sheol." But for the righteous, it gets better than deliverance from Sheol. Psalm 49 states that the foolish are assigned to Sheol. But then in verse 16 in this psalm, the psalmist contrasted his destiny with that of the foolish. "God will redeem my soul from the hand of Sheol, for he will take me." This verse is good news for the people of God. Our destiny is not the same as the destiny of the foolish. We're not assigned to Sheol. To the contrary, we're redeemed from Sheol. But not only will we avoid the place of punishment, the psalmist wrote that just as God took Enoch, He will take us to Himself. Not only are we delivered from eternal punishment, but we are taken into the presence of God Himself. And Psalm 16 goes even further than that. In Psalm 16:10, the psalmist wrote, "You will not forsake my soul to Sheol." And then he, like the author of Psalm 49, wrote of being in the presence of the Lord forever. And he wrote, "In your presence is fullness of joy. In your right hand there are pleasures forever." Could the different, the better destiny of the righteous be stated more fully or more magnificently? We will not languish in a place of punishment as will the godless. Instead, we enjoy the pleasures that are the gracious and glorious consequence of being in the presence of the true and sovereign God of the universe. And we will enjoy those pleasures forever. Being in the presence of God forever is also expressed elsewhere in the Old Testament as the destiny of the righteous. Psalm 73, after the psalmist moved beyond his erstwhile doubts, he testified it to the Lord, "With your counsel you will guide me, and afterward receive me to glory. My strength and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." Not merely in this life, but forever. Let us not forget that beautiful affirmation of Psalm 23, verse 6. "And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." This is the better country. This is the better resurrection that was anticipated by the saints of the Old Testament, mentioned by the author of Hebrews. And this is the future of all those who love the Lord. And I remind us in closing that these statements are not in the New Testament. They're in the Old Testament. And whereas they fall short of the more developed doctrine of the afterlife in the New Testament, they do not contradict that doctrine. To the contrary, they complement it and prepare us for it. So I say, while the Lord gives us breath on this earth, may we joyfully anticipate our future in His presence and urgently warn those who do not know the Lord, lest they spend eternity without Him in hell, which the Old Testament calls Sheol. Thank you.